The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode 2, season 2 of In Conversation with Ashwin. It's been a while, and I've stopped doing these as frequently, but, you know, with this, I hope to pick the rhythm back up. On today's episode, we have Suhail Shehrzad, a dear friend of mine who I've spent a lot of time in college with. We were a part of the same debating team, we went to the same college, and, you know, we've been friends ever since. Suhail recently went through an accident that made him lose a part of a limb, which we'll get into, but a large part of this episode is going to dive into how he's recovered from that accident, how that's influenced life for him, and then how the recovery has been. Without further ado, I will let Suhail introduce himself. And Suhail, thanks for being on the show, man. Happy to have you here.
Of course.
Okay, so for question one, I usually keep this pretty standard for every episode of mine. Tell us a little about your early childhood and how that's influenced the person you've become or are becoming.
Sure. First of all, Ashwin, thank you so much for having me on. It's such a pleasure to be here and such a pleasure to always at any time, you know, have a conversation with you. Though since college, like over the past 10 years, we've lived in different cities and we've moved around a lot, each of us. I feel like it's always been such a treat to talk to you over a weekend or whenever we have some time on our schedule. So about my childhood and early life, I was born in Muscat, Oman, which is a country in the Middle East. And shortly thereafter, my parents moved around a lot. So I went from Oman to the United States, where we were in Detroit for some time. We were in Chicago for some time. We came back to India, where I was in Kerala for 2 years, for just the first and second grade. Following that, we went to Dubai. And I like to say that, like, you know, most people in Kerala, I grew up in Dubai, because of course, Dubai has a massive Indian and specifically Keralite expat population outside of India, but it was very much within an Indian community, surrounded by literally dozens of my own family members as well from Kerala, who had settled in Dubai or Sharjah or Abu Dhabi. So we used to get together during holidays. And it was in that sense, a childhood which had a lot of family support around me. And that's something which, looking back especially, is a huge influence on my life. Metaphor that's used a lot is that it's like an oasis. It's an urban oasis in the Middle East. And that is a fair characterization in some ways. At the same time, you know, it can be an isolated existence compared to growing up in India. Houses tend to be quite spread out. Apartment buildings tend to be quite spread out. I used to really enjoy the summers when school was off and we would travel back to Kerala or to New Delhi, where my grandfather was, and spend the 2 months of summer there. Those were summers which I spent mostly reading. My father was actually a very avid reader himself, especially in his youth. So in my grandmother's bookcase, she had all of my dad's childhood books. I mean, like shelf after shelf of them. So every summer I would go back to Kerala and I would just pore over these books one after the next. And I think that that was always a major influence of my life growing up. My grandparents never let me take any of those books back to Dubai. So whatever I could finish that summer is all that I could read. And then I would have to wait until next year when I could come back and read through them. Pretty soon, by like the seventh or eighth grade, I had actually finished all of my father's childhood books. And then he started giving me other books, which he read when he was in college, books which he was currently reading at the time as well. So that was a way in which I always connected with my dad a lot. My grades were fine. My grades were not like exceptional, but I always knew that that's something that I had to take care of to make sure that everyone at home is satisfied. So I took care of that. But my interest very soon by like the 10th and 11th grade just became basketball, along with like waking up at 4 a.m. or 3:30 a.m. to like watch the NBA games in Dubai. Before going to basketball practice at 6 a.m., I was also like playing on the school team and practicing 6 days a week. And after practice in the morning, which used to be from about 6 a.m. to maybe 7:30 or 8 a.m., I used to play with my friends in the neighborhood as well. I grew up in a neighborhood called Dera in Dubai. Other places too, but Dera is especially where I played a lot of basketball with people from, frankly, all nationalities. The universal language is often said to be football. For me, the universal language was basketball. So looking back on it, especially, I would say that it was a very happy childhood. Following that, I came to Chennai for college, which is where we met, of course. I could really key in a little bit more into academics because I was finally studying the subjects that I cared about the most, which is economics and international trade, things of that nature. And that's also when I joined the debate team. Met people like you who were so much smarter than me, but you guys were all very welcoming and took me into the fold. And that was a great experience, which helped me sort of build my confidence, especially in speaking in front of audiences, preparing debate notes, and that process of preparation and competing went from the basketball court to extracurriculars and debate societies. That was definitely a major influence in my outlook on life, I would say. Because coming into college, I figured that I would work in maybe something in banking or finance. But by the time I left college, I was very convinced that I wanted to learn a lot more about public policy issues in India, which is why I started a fellowship with an NGO where I was a full-time school teacher in New Delhi in an under-resourced municipal school. And that experience was really an eye-opening one. I got to interact with people from all walks of life. I got to teach a classroom of fourth graders and students who had a very resource-constrained environment that they were growing up in. And frankly, a municipal corporation system in New Delhi, which was not functioning very well. And students had all sorts of challenges that they had to face, not only in the realm of education, but also in healthcare and access to opportunities. After that, I worked at a think tank in New Delhi for another year, which was an eye-opening experience. I was sort of working on the grassroots of public policy as an intern there, before which I came to the US for my master's. And that's where I studied international relations and international politics. I also met my lovely wife at graduate school, after which I joined the World Bank, where I was in Washington, D.C. for about 3.5 or 4 years. Recently, about a year ago, I moved to New York, and now I work in risk management here in New York.
Damn, you summed that up real well. I said you'd wake up at 3:30 a.m., you'd watch games, then you'd go for practice, and then you'd have a whole day of school after you. Is that really what you did for months?
Yeah, for months on end, and then I would have school, and after school, I would come back home and go play basketball again for like another 2 or 3 hours. It was like half-court basketball in the evenings.
Yeah.
So we weren't running around too much. But yeah, I was just playing basketball all day. It was amazing.
Actually, whenever I think about you, Sohail, I think about politics and I think about ball. So even the book reading makes so much sense, where you would just swallow books up in 2 months and kind of, you know, become that avid reader, taking after your dad. So that is so interesting. Now onto the accident. I just wanted you to tell listeners what happened and how has that ended up just changing everything in your world? How is it shaking it up?
Absolutely. There was no premonition that day when I woke up. Well, I was recovering from COVID. So I had contracted COVID. This is March of 2024. COVID's not very serious anymore. So I recovered quite well from COVID without any medicine or antivirals or anything like that. Try not to play like the what if game, which is thinking, what if this happened or what if that happened? But I really can't help myself from thinking that, like, man, what if I just stayed home that day? You know, that would have been such a great decision. Mm-hmm. If only we knew, right? But I was feeling a little bit weak that day. I had some work. I wrapped that up. And I hadn't eaten breakfast or lunch either. I mean, I didn't have much of an appetite coming out of the sickness in any case. And generally, I'm not someone who eats breakfast very often. especially like, you know, in years prior to March 2024. These days, I always make sure to have like at least a piece of fruit and something like that in the morning. And at about 3 p.m., I left home to go and meet some friends at about 5 or 6 p.m. And I figured, like, after I reach there a little bit early, I can grab a bite. And, you know, it sounds so stupid when I recollect it, but I left home recovering from COVID, hadn't eaten that day, and just thought that I would be totally fine. Really, unfortunately, I mean, I was not totally fine. What happened was that I was in the subway in New York, and I was changing platforms. While I was waiting for the train to arrive, I lost consciousness. And, you know, as fate would have it, someone just the other day was telling me that they lost consciousness on a subway platform, but they fell backwards. I was really unfortunate because I fell forwards onto the track. It was a pretty bad injury. I'm very lucky that the platform was quite crowded. So bystanders were able to cause a commotion that literally saved my life because they managed to stop the oncoming train. So I did not actually make contact with the train. But in that fall alone, it's like a 6 to 7 foot drop. And I struck my left leg first, most likely, because my left leg had a pretty bad compound fracture with bone sticking out and all of that. That's about when I lost consciousness. So I don't really remember what happened after that. But looking at the reports of the accident, basically, fire department was on the scene to fish me out of the tracks. I was bleeding quite profusely from my left leg. My right foot also had significant injuries, but the left leg was the big concern. So they tied a tourniquet above my left knee. For the listeners who don't know, that's basically like a rubber band, or in an emergency situation, you can even use your own belt as a tourniquet. But it basically is tied extremely tightly over your injured appendage, like your arms or your legs, to stop bleeding. And it's a life-saving emergency procedure. So the firefighters who applied the tourniquet absolutely saved my life, because when I arrived in the hospital, I was told when I woke up that I had actually lost about 50% of the blood in my body. I required multiple blood transfusions. So that tourniquet definitely did save my life. But, you know, everything in life has a trade-off, as they like to tell us in economics. And the trade-off with a tourniquet is that it basically kills the leg. It becomes, I learned a new word out of this accident, which is ischemic. Basically means that the limb is not responsive and it's essentially dead. So when I arrived in the hospital, they performed an emergency amputation. I was very lucky because I was just literally blocks away from one of New York's largest hospitals, which has an excellent trauma center and an excellent surgery team on standby there. So I was given very good treatment, very good emergency treatment. And, you know, it's so incredible to even read the report. They literally applied hundreds of almost microscopic stitches to tie off all the veins and arteries and capillaries and all of that to basically save my life on the spot. So yeah, when I woke up, by then they had already contacted my wife, Deepshika, who works here in New York. She had informed my family. So when I woke up, I was basically surrounded by my extremely concerned family. And I was initially quite shocked, but I also had a lot of gratitude that, you know, I'm actually here. And everyone around me was so grateful when I woke up, because I was unconscious for a couple of days before I finally came to. And I was told that in the process, I had several blood transfusions required, several surgeries, and so on. But really grateful to be here at the end of all of that.
First of all, so sorry. And I've heard this story before from you when I visited you at the hospital. How many days were you unconscious for?
So I was unconscious for about 2 days until I started waking up. And I was still very heavily medicated at the time. So basically, my first memories are about 2 days in, but they're still quite blurry. And even for those 2 days, I mean, I was like receiving IV fluids, but also because of like the nature of the accident, they had given me all types of prophylactic antibiotics, to antibiotics that they give you just in case, like to prevent an infection. So I was receiving broad spectrum antibiotics, I was receiving pain medication. I was a little bit loopy for the first couple of days.
I was with you maybe a month after the accident happened, and you were already in good spirits, like, you know, using humor to cope, which you do so wonderfully well. Just curious, how did you try to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, and you know, talking to other people who've been through these types of accidents as well, one thing which I felt very strongly happened in my case was that I felt a complete lack of control over the future. I mean, if you think about anyone's daily life, like whether you're a small child or whether you're an adult, you're able to forecast so much into the future where you're able to see, okay, next week I'm going to do this, tomorrow morning I'm going to do this, or a month from now I'm probably going to do this, or I might be doing that. Well, when I woke up in the hospital bed, I basically had no idea what was going to happen to me 2 days down the line or 5 months down the line. And then the longer you forecast that out, you know, the more confusing everything becomes. And that was a very uncomfortable prospect that definitely was instigating, I'll admit, you know, a lot of emotions of fear and uncertainty that unlike anything I've ever felt before. And like I said, my family was also there. So along with my wife, my uncle, my brother, my sister, and my mom were also in the room. They were all just looking so concerned. And I'd been informed that I lost my left leg below the knee, which is better than losing your left leg above the knee, I was told. And I was like, okay, I don't comprehend what the difference is at the time or any of that, you know. But they said that I'll likely be able to walk with a prosthetic if the next couple of months go well. And then the doctor sort of left the room. And then I figured that, you know, I want to set a goal for myself, which is how I've always approached any type of challenge that I have. And even if I have a challenge, like let's say in the workplace or academically, I always like to set even a physical goal or a mental goal for myself. So in that time I said, okay, in 2025, no matter what happens, I'm going to run a half marathon. So a half marathon is, as you know, 21 kilometers. Many years ago, like I finished a whole handful of them before I stopped because of some injuries and all of that. But I figured, you know what, next year, a half marathon is going to be absolutely doable. I wanted to get back into running shape anyway. And this is as good an impetus as any of them. So my uncle immediately said, I'll also run it with you. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, I was like, well, Uncle Nazir, like, are you sure? Like, you know, it's not as easy as you think. And he was like, oh, my God, you're the one telling me that. But, you know, just setting that goal, it gave me like a vision and something to sort of hang on to that, like, OK, you know what? It doesn't matter what's going to happen in the next couple of days or in the next week. No matter what, I'm going to work towards this goal of being able to run this half marathon next year. So that goal setting definitely really helped me a lot in that early moment. It gave me something to think about. That being said, I mean, the process itself was not easy by any stretch. It's definitely one of the most difficult, actually just the most difficult thing I've had to go through.
Just before I get into that, like how many days or how many weeks in have you set this goal of doing a marathon, half marathon in 2025? Like how many days since the accident?
Oh, this was like within half an hour of waking up, basically. I didn't know how necessarily realistic it would be either, but I figured that, you know what, if I at least have that vision of, you know, going through the process and being able to go through the training and all of that, like, you know, you need something that makes you feel like it's all going to be worth it, mm-hmm. you know, because it's very easy to just sort of think that, like, man, I might never walk again, or, oh, I might never be able to run again, or I might never be able to do this again or that again. And, you know, it can just snowball and it can be very overwhelming.
Yeah. And so you, like, just fought it with a challenge that you set yourself up and always, you know, kind of use the trick of motivation to not fall in that spiral.
Yeah. And, like, you know, I'm absolutely like not superhuman, because I still went into all kinds of different spirals and all of that. Because one thing that I was told very early on by my physiotherapist at the hospital, because, you know, interestingly, the day after my major surgery, the physiotherapist actually came into the room and they convinced me to stand up. And actually, when they entered the room and they were like, hey, where are your physiotherapists? I was literally like, hey, can we just talk about physiotherapy today? I don't think I'm ready to do physiotherapy. And they just started laughing. They were like, yeah, sure, talk about physiotherapy. No, get your ass up. So, you know, they kind of got me onto the walker, and they got me, like, I could barely even honestly hold on to the walker or stand up. You know, it was so difficult. because I was so medicated at the time and I just wasn't used to it. But over time, like, you know, one weekend, every day I was seeing progress and every day I felt like I was getting stronger until like about a weekend, suddenly I didn't feel like I was stronger. Like the pain felt worse. My arms felt more tired. My core felt more tired and I was just exhausted. I was sweating and I was like, man, I feel like I'm taking steps backward. Like, you know, no pun intended. But my physiotherapist said that recovery is not linear. So you can't always expect to be on like a linear path, right? It's not always going to go upwards day after day or just downwards either day after day. It's always like some ups and some downs. And what you want to look at is sort of like the trend and make sure that the trend is going upwards because on the day to day, it's never going to be linear. So even for me mentally, I would say that like, yeah, within like the first half an hour of waking up, I did have a goal and I was feeling very motivated for 2025. And I figured I'm going to be fine in a year's time. But, you know, there were always times when it wasn't exactly linear. Like 2 or 3 days later, I had some low moments and I had some better moments. But looking back, I would say that, yes, the trend was always trending upward for me.
And let's talk a little about your support system coming out from the accident and, you know, having family around for the first few days must have felt, you said they were quite concerned. And obviously, they were also getting used to the fact that something so drastic has happened to you. But let's say a month after that, when people have gotten back to their routines, obviously, Deepshika has been a pillar of support. And I love her, too, just as much as I love you, because I saw how much of a boss she was in terms of handling the situation. So Deepshika, you're listening. You know, just shout out to you for being the pillar of support that you have been. And your mom as well, right? Like, outside of that, like, what was support for you like? And what did you crave? Did you make yourself expressive in terms of you need that support? Or were you kind of just receiving what you got and you were happy with that? So where were you on that?
It's very difficult to, like, describe or put into words what my own needs necessarily were at that time. Because I had so much uncertainty about the future, and I also had so much physical pain at that particular time, almost a sense of loss of identity in some regard. So it was very difficult for me to like articulate what support really meant at that time. But somehow, like, Deepshika and my family and everyone really just sort of had a way of knowing and providing whatever support was needed at that time. I mean, sometimes it was just an empathetic ear, you know, just hearing me out. But other times it can also, if someone is always just validating you and someone's always just listening passively, then what I might need in that moment is someone to actually check me a little bit, right? And say, hey, things aren't so bad. Like, you know, you don't need to get so down on yourself, or you don't need to feel so negative about it. And then there are some other times when, you know, I might have felt a lot more pain than I was comfortable with. And for them to say, no, that's okay. You know, that's natural to feel that. So it's very hard to sort of describe the myriad of ways in which they provided support, because it was really in every imaginable way. All I would say is that, like, if anyone is going through any kind of difficult moment in their life, it doesn't have to be like a serious accident. You know, it could even be just any stumbling block professionally or academically or in any other walk of life, I would say that it's really important to sort of trust that the people who have your best interests in mind and the people who do love you are saying it for a reason, and they're really providing that support in the best way that they can. So I found a lot of solace in knowing that I can absolutely trust the intentions of people around me, and that gave me so much belief in the words and their actions as well, because intentions are really what matter. I would also say that it's important to sort of disconnect from the reality of like just the problem sitting in front of you, right? Because there's a professor of negotiations called Daniel Shapiro who says that, you know, when you sometimes when you put words to emotions and you say, I feel sad because of this, because of this, because of this, because of this, actually you're filling in details yourself. And you're actually adding more color to the situation and more granularity to that situation. And sometimes it's better to just disconnect from it a little bit and think about something else for some time. And I found that to be a true blessing as well, where with my wife, as well as with my mom, and my sister, and my brother, and my uncle, I could always talk to them about something else, and we could always just discuss something else as well, you know, and that's why it's so important to have those types of shared connections, I think, through your life. And it was such a coincidence that you were visiting New York at that time in March, and it was so nice of you to come by the hospital at that time. And, you know, I remember it was like such a nice visit, and we could like reminisce about all types of different things and just talk about each other's weddings or college or anything else, you know. And so just that basic shared connection also goes a very long way in moments of difficulty.
You remind me of, you know, something that hasn't left me ever since I came to see you. It's made such an impact in my life because generally, Sohail, I think about this once a week. When you said to me, lying down on your stretch of bed, you said, hey, I could have been gone. I got a second life. And, you know, that's really influenced me to be happier in life in general. So thanks for that. And what has that meant to you? And just saying that you got a second life to actually having these lofty dreams and aspirations.
Sure. I mean, yes, absolutely. I think that I'm definitely one of the luckiest people on earth just to be here and just to get the second chance that I received. I mean, the statistics to me were just astounding. The New York City subway, I think, has 1 to 2 million daily riders, and it's hard for them to keep track of an exact number because there are so many people who aren't necessarily using the fare system as well. But it's about 1 to 2 million daily riders, out of which about 300 people a year for the past several years lose their lives on the subway. And about an equal number of them have injuries as serious as losing a limb or a permanent disability. So just looking at, when I heard those numbers alone, I did feel like, you know, I'm just absolutely lucky to be here. And there are so many different mental models and ways of looking at it that can square that notion a little bit for me. I mean, one way I think of it is that I had this accident in 2024 and I needed to have my left leg amputated. But amputations are actually one of the oldest medical treatments that have ever existed. People have been having amputations in wars and accidents spanning back literally thousands of years. Maybe even before recorded history, people were going through amputations to save lives. Now, looking at it from that lens, I felt that I might be one of the most fortunate, humane, and well looked after amputations in human history, considering that I was at a hospital, I had medical staff. I was not in a remote location where this treatment had to happen, disconnected from an operating theater, which still happens today, even in 2024. So looking at it that way definitely made me feel lucky. That being said, you know, this is just one mental model. You can look at it with statistics or with history or with anything else. And it depends on sort of what resonates for you. But whichever way it is that resonates the most, I felt an overwhelming feeling that I need to achieve all the things that I ever wanted to achieve, and I need to experience all the things that I ever wanted to experience in the limited time that I have on this earth. I mean, it all sounds very cliched until you undergo like a serious thing in life, right? Before that, it all seems like a cliche. But for example, I realized that after I got, just looking at physical activities alone, from the spectrum, which goes from like running, which is very likely that I'll be able to do. Like I said, I have this goal and I'm going to achieve it. And so I'm very confident that with a prosthetic, I will run again.
And do you have a prosthetic already?
Not yet. So I'm getting fitted for a prosthetic. It's in the works, but it takes time. And it's like an iterative process, really. So I haven't gotten my first prosthetic yet. But it's only a matter of time. And looking at the spectrum of things I can and cannot do, I mean, running, I can almost definitely do like a year from now. A little bit lower, maybe like tennis. I think I might be able to play tennis. There's also like a lot of videos and so on of people with prosthetic legs playing tennis. So I think that might be realistic. If we look at the other end of the spectrum, something like football, like soccer or football, I think that's quite unrealistic, right? I don't think that I'm going to be able to play soccer again. So Unfortunately, I think basketball might be a little bit towards like the football end of the spectrum and not so close to the tennis end. But I'm thinking about something I've never done before, right? Like I've never gone surfing before. And I'm like, crap, I don't think I'll, maybe I can, maybe not, right? But when I was like 25, or even if you told me like a year ago, I'd be like, yeah, I have my whole life to go surfing. Like I'll just, go to a beach somewhere and like spend a week and try it out. Whereas now I feel like, wow, the clock's ticking, like if I haven't done this before, then I only have that much time left to do it right now. And so surfing, I'm not sure about, but I really want to get scuba certified by Paddy. I went for one intro scuba diving class like 6 years ago and I loved it, right? And after that, I just kind of like weak excuses, right? Never got the time, never had the this or the that. And so I never put on scuba gear since then. But I've always thought I just have more time to do it. And now I'm like, oh my God, this was so close to me making that an impossibility, but it's not, right? I can go scuba diving. And in fact, I've already been swimming and I'm going swimming these days like 3 or 4 times a week. And the water, I feel totally fine. It's amazing. I feel this immense sense of gratitude for like the day I have and the week I have ahead of me and the month and the year I have ahead of me, because time feels so much more limited, right? I mean, it's funny how that works, that scarcity creates like more value, but that's how I'm like looking at my life these days.
Man, you're dropping these economic gems every part of the conversation. I love it. Scarcity creates value. That's awesome. And then, I've also loved the Instagram content you've been putting out, by the way. Just I know you
I
do it probably
appreciate
on
it.
your phone and the music and the pump. Like if I'm seeing your reel, I'm motivated for the week. So I want to end with two questions. One, if you had to gift a book to somebody, which one would it be? And take your time. And number two is if you had to write one thing on a wall for the world to see, what would it be?
So regarding the book, I would say that like growing up, I really enjoyed a lot of the British mystery novels, like your Sherlock Holmes and Agatha Christie and Perry Mason. I think Perry Mason might be American, but like these British mystery novels from like the early 20th century. But more recently, I've been reading more about philosophy and politics. And I think a great gift of a book, because when you're gifting a book, it can't be too like thick of a book as well. That's almost like a sentence that you're passing someone, no pun intended. But like a thin volume that I really enjoyed is called Lotus in a Sea of Fire. It's by a Vietnamese philosopher called Thich Nhat Hanh. I finished it recently and it was first written in 1967. It's about political and cultural underpinnings of Vietnam at the time of the US-Vietnam War. And there were so many conflicts in Vietnam at that particular time, so many competing ideologies. And this is actually Thich Nhat Hanh's first book. He later wrote much more extensively about Buddhism and philosophy, but this is a little bit more of a political novel and a short one too, that I think makes for a very interesting read, especially for someone who's interested in the intersection of history and philosophy and conflict and competing ideologies. This is really a must read.
I love that. You said Lotus in a Sea of Fire, right?
Yes.
Okay. For listeners, I'll put that link in the chat. And yeah, now on to the next one. What is one thing you'd write for the world to see?
So I was reading a book recently which had a very interesting quote that I wrote down in my own notes app on my phone. And I think that I'd be happy to write it on a wall as well. It's by an American playwright and musical composer called Sondheim. And the quote is, "All that matters in the world is who gets to eat and who gets eaten."
Let's say more.
I just found it to be a very interesting quote. I think about it all the time recently, and I think about what it means to live in this society where it feels really like dog eat dog, and it feels like we're all at each other's throat. It's a tension between who gets to eat and who gets eaten. But at the same time, doesn't have to be that way. It's referring to food. And of course, we don't have to eat each other. We can all work towards a different purpose, and we can work towards feeding hungry mouths without eating each other. It might sound a little bit dark, but I like that it's a little bit thought-provoking as well.
And open-ended, right? Yeah, that's great.